everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. How exercising your muscles combats chronic inflammation on its own. Duke University School of Nursing. Very important article published in the peer-reviewed journal Science Advances. Also today, I'll be discussing how juicing techniques could influence the healthfulness of freshly squeezed juice. The American Chemical Society published in their American Chemical Society Food and Science Technology magazine. So for those of you who say, should I get the newest juicer or a blender, I'm going to describe all that in some detail. Also from Satmana University in Japan comes a study about stiffening of cancer cell membranes is the key to biophysical mechanisms of cancer prevention by green tea. And I'll explain what that means so you can stimulate your own immune system. Also from the Military Institute of Medicine in Poland comes a study about what happens when you don't have enough vitamin D. Well, it's associated with allergic diseases in children. That's important because we have more sick children now than ever before. And the Journal of General Psychiatry, published in their current issue, afternoon napping is linked to better mental agility. That means you're more aware, you're more verbally fluent, you have a better working memory by taking a nap. Well, how long should the nap be? So I'll talk about that. And also today, how melatonin in the lungs prevents infection by the novel coronavirus, University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. That's important. Another thing that can help us when it comes to COVID-19 prevention, we should all be concerned about that. But then I have another one, University of Massachusetts. A healthy microbiome buildup means good bacteria from a good diet builds a strong immune system that could help defeat COVID-19. Well, why isn't this front page of the New York Times? Two studies I'm going to share with you today could help lessen your likelihood of succumbing or spreading or getting very sick from COVID-19. Two simple things, inexpensive. It's in the peer-reviewed literature. Everything I share comes from PubMed, but you're not going to hear any of it in the mainstream media. It's vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. By the way, have they been keeping up with how many people died? 181 people we know of has died in the last 2 weeks after receiving the COVID vaccine. 181. But they'll say it's for the greater good. I challenge that, and we'll deal with that. Also, in around the world, people are dying. If you've ever been to Gibraltar, a beautiful place, now you know why people go there to retire. Magnificent views, great climate, nice people, and a whole international array of backgrounds, ethnicities. Lots of people dying there after getting the vaccine, way more than what we have been told. And yet, not a word about that in the United States that I can find. Yet it's important. As a percentage of their tiny population, that should send a chill up people's back that maybe this wasn't the vaccinate versus unvaccinate debate, but rather, is this a safe vaccine? And wait till it is, the precautionary principle. And speaking of studies, a brand new study from looking at a control group done by Joy Gamer, meticulous research. And it talks about one group unvaccinated, another group fully vaccinated. And the results were, and I'm posting this on PRN.fm, that the unvaccinated were substantially, by measures, healthier than the vaccinated group. And all of this is fully referenced with the peer-reviewed literature. Then why aren't we having this discussion? But we're not. Also today, we're going to go to the defense of a professor from Yale University who is getting hammered. You'll hear his testimony before Congress. You will hear him being interviewed by a pro-pharmacy advocate on CNN that attacks him nonstop, irrespective of the fact that he defends himself properly. And then I'm going to read a letter from a lot of his colleagues at Yale attacking him, saying that his support of hydroxychloroquine is unwarranted. And is it? I don't believe so. I believe he is right on, but we're going to have Richard Gale, who has reviewed every single study in the world literature on hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, which is even better. And we will be offering all of those professors at Yale a challenge. And we do our homework. That's our program. Let's begin. Biomedical engineers at Duke University have demonstrated that human muscle has an innate ability to ward off damaging effects of chronic inflammation when exercised. The discovery was made possible through the use of lab-grown muscle, demonstrating the potential power of the first-of-its-kind platform in such research, and is published in the peer-reviewed journal Science Advances. So what it means is that when you're exercising, unless you're over-exercising, which is immunosuppressive and very inflammatory, the muscle itself, when exercised, has the capacity of being anti-inflammatory in its own right. So I believe that you have to have a double backup. Keep in mind, inflammation is not inherently good or bad. When the body is injured, an initial low-level inflammation response clears away debris and helps tissues rebuild. Other times, the immune system overreacts, increase an inflammatory response that causes damage, like the often deadly cytokine storms brought on by COVID-19. And then there are diseases that lead to chronic inflammation, like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, sarcopenia, dementia, which can cause muscles to waste away and weaken its ability to contract. So among many molecules that can cause inflammation, one pro-inflammatory molecule in particular, interferon gamma, has been associated with various types of muscle wasting and dysfunction. And while previous research in humans and animals has shown that excess exercise, or even just normal exercise, can help mitigate the effects of inflammation in general, it's been difficult to distinguish what role the muscle cells themselves might play, let alone how they interact with specific offending molecules, such as interferon gamma. But this time they did this study and showed that normal exercise creates its own immune response and it can control interferon gamma for 7 days to mimic the effects of long-lasting chronic inflammation. And so we have the ability, if we don't over-exercise, to actually prevent the effects of chronic inflammation from exercising. That's good. Now, probably one of the most common questions I'm asked, it's a very basic but a very legitimate question, is I want to start juicing. Good. That's terrific. What you juice is important, but also how you juice. The assumption is that any kind of juice, no matter how it's made, is good. And indeed, that is true. But then you have to parse, am I getting more phytonutrients, more antioxidants, more vitamin C if I juice with one kind of apparatus or machine versus another? Well, helping us answer this was the American Chemical Society in their current issue of their Food and Science Technology Reports. And mind you, a lot of people are beginning to juice, especially those who've been homebound and realize that drinking carbonated sugared beverages can lead to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. It also gives you calories your body doesn't need and leads to body mass index, your belly and thighs getting heavier, and that leads to higher incidence of heart disease and cancers. And by the way, just as an aside, I just saw, after it had gone through independent review, the statistics from the report that has now gone out. Again, I don't send the reports out for peer review. That's all done independently. And hopefully we'll get it, but I saw the results. We had the highest amount of body fat index loss, meaning people going from 30, 40% fat, which is dangerous. That's suicidal. To way down in the teens, some even below 10. That's terrific. And mind you, they did this with no starving diet, just eating the healthiest foods imaginable and juicing 12 times a day. That alone, if that's the only thing the anti-aging study achieved, it would make it remarkably successful. But it did far more than that. We measured 47 different indices of improvement. That was just one. So if you want to get rid of a lot of body fat, start to power walk and juice and have your last meal no later than 6 o'clock. And there are going to be exceptions to that, of course, when you go out dining or go to before a Broadway show or concert or afterwards. I understand that. But I'm talking about on a regular basis, try to have 12 hours in between your last meal and breakfast. In any case, so they took a look at the different juices. Now, anyone who has their own juice machine knows that there are different types. For example, blenders, and very powerful, very expensive blenders, they simply pulverize the vegetables. They have very fast, sharp blades, and the juice is typically thick. You've got a tremendous amount of high-quality fiber in the pulp. And in contrast, when you use one of the high-speed centrifugal machines, it does it very quickly, extracts and extrudes the pulp and fiber, and you're left with the juice. And it's a thinner juice, more watery, because there's more water in it. Remember, about 97% of all juice is water. And then you have the very low-speed juice extractors that squeeze juice with a horizontal auger that rotates vegetables at a low speed. By the way, that produces the least heat of the three methods, and it also removes pulp and fiber. So what'd they find? Well, the group of scientists down at Texas A&M compared the phytochemical and antioxidant contents of 19 vegetables juiced with three different techniques that I just mentioned. After preparing juices with different methods, the researchers observed that in general, blending produces juices with the lowest amount of the beneficial compounds, like vitamin C and antioxidants, phenolics, probably because the technique produced the most heat. Low-speed juicing generates the highest amount of beneficial compounds. So here's the irony. When everyone's going speed, fast, power, you're getting the least results. Go slow. In fact, for all citrus and even melons, by the way, a cantaloupe, honeydew, a watermelon, and there's nothing better when you're hot to take some watermelon, juice it, and then also juice some lemons and limes with it. That is just, and chill it. Oh, that's just terrific. And loaded with lycopene and other healing nutrients. So if you want the best input in your body, and this also, you're getting the highest amount of what are called amylase inhibitors, which could help reduce hyperglycemia or high blood sugar after a meal or even after a juice. The researchers used spectrometry and chemometrics to identify and qualify 85 metabolites in juices prepared by the three methods. Here's it again, the low-speed juicer, the low-speed, or that hand juicer, you know, where you, the little, has a little basket and you cut your oranges. Oh, by the way, when you cut your oranges, do it in grapefruit, lemons, limes. Do it always this way. First, you put on your detergent, like a veggie wash. Scrub it down, agitate it, water, clean it. Then you cut it in half. Always smell the orange or lemon or lime. Make sure it smells fresh. And then wash that. Just run water over it. And run water over your knife. Why? Because a lot of people don't realize that when you go into a store, you have no idea how sanitary or not a particular item that was juiced could be. And I can tell you, being an avid juicer, that I've seen people take carrots out of a bag without washing them, root vegetables, including beets, out of a bag, and just juicing them. And when I say, oh, hold on, friend, you didn't wash it. Oh, they're organic. Yeah, and your feces are organic. You want to put your feces on your hand, let people know it's there? Hey, I have feces hands. Take a look. You can't see it, but it's there. And I'm now touching your food, which is now you've got my feces in your body. Good luck with that. No. We're a very dirty nation. My God. You know, people wipe and they don't wash. I mean, we are just so grossly unsanitary. We would fit right in. The average American would just be right at home in Louis XIV's Versailles. No, they didn't wash either. They didn't even wipe. They just pulled down their pants and went in Versailles, and that was it, and someone swept it up, and no hygiene. Imagine the people in the kitchen. Nothing was washed. They didn't have running water, and hands weren't washed. Perfume and wigs, yeah. Makeup on the face and expensive clothes, yeah. And dirty, filthy bodies. Some people would never bathe, ever. So just remember, what's on the skin of that avocado, on that cucumber, on that orange, if you don't wash it off, then it's in your body. How do you think so many Americans end up with food poisoning every year? It's not just because eating, you know, some egg salad in the summertime at a picnic. It goes to the simple things, like a recent outbreak of food poisoning was in people eating guacamole. I just went to a farmer's market this past. I go to about 6 farmer's markets on Saturday and Sunday to get food for myself and the animals. And I like to buy locally grown organic produce, support the local farmers. And there was a person making guacamole. They had a long line of people there. And I'm watching the person take avocados out of a box, cut them, and throw them into a bowl, mash them up. No washing. As if somehow someone had magically washed those skins before it got there. No, that doesn't happen. And as a result, about a year ago, a whole big outbreak of food poisoning came because the outside of an avocado was not washed. Remember, the inside didn't have the disease. When your knife cuts through the skin, the knife then smears the flesh inside. Always, 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 never, no exception, you wash before you eat. You wash your hands repeatedly. You wash the food. Every single item I feed, 24 different fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, to the animals, it gets washed. Then natural immunity means when they're out there, the hoof stock, for example, and they're eating, they're pulling up all kinds of bacteria from the ground, but their body's building a natural immunity to that. Remember, an animal doesn't have natural immunity to your feces-laden fingers. So keep that in mind. That's why I never eat anything anyone else has ever made for me, including my own daughter. God. Yeah. Yeah, that ain't going to work. Forget that. Anything I eat, it has to be cooked. But this is raw. Yeah, and I know what all the different parts of the body that raw could have come out of. No, thank you. I just saw you cough and sneeze and in your hand, and then you rub your hand together. Wow, what a wonderful antiseptic method. It just gets rid of all the bacteria, and that snot just goes away. It's no longer there. So when you touch that banana you're putting in a smoothie and you're going to give me a drink of smoothie, I appreciate the gesture. Don't appreciate the orifice, you know, ejections. Keep that in mind if you only knew what comes out of restaurant kitchens. Having owned 3 of the most successful restaurants, vegan restaurants, the first gourmet vegan restaurant in American history, the Old Fertile Earth. Wonder if any of you go back that far to 1971 to 1980 when I had that at 108th and Broadway. Interesting because I was recently, just before I left the city, was up on the Upper West Side, and I just wanted to walk up to see how it has changed. Really has changed. Riverside Drive is beautiful all the way up. Those old pre-war buildings, wonderful. I think Columbia University is the largest landowner up there. They buy them for, give them to their faculty to use. But there at 108th and Broadway was the health food store I opened in 1967, still open, a little tiny sliver of a store, you know, not very big, still open. But in the next block was the Fertile Earth restaurant. So I'm looking in the place that it is now, and people started coming up on the street. And it was kind of fun because this this person who was a broker who was showing me spaces said, "You know all these people?" I said, "Well, these people used to eat in this that long ago? Yeah, these are the people." And I remembered them. That was wonderful, wonderful hour just talking with people. And they told me all the stories, how they used to see all of the radical anti-war activists that would meet there every night. That was their go-to place. You could always tell when there was an FBI, you know, plant in there because they always dressed differently. You could always point them out. Look at their socks. Look at how neatly their clothes are pressed. In any case, it was a wonderful time. There was a table in the back, always reserved for my buddy, no matter if he was in town or not, Peter Max, all kinds of activists. Anyhow, just a little side there. So just keep in mind cleanliness, because I used to be emphatic about hygiene and cleanliness to the staff. And no matter how many times you tell them, they can still screw up. You don't want to get sick because someone screws up. So you now know, use the juicing machines that you put, cut an orange and then push it down. That's going to give you the highest degree of nutrients. There's no heat. There's no pulp. It's all good. That's the best way to have any kind of juice that you can use that machine on. I can do that with honeydew melon, Crenshaw melon, cantaloupe, watermelon. I can do that. Any kind of orange, nectarine, tangerine, I can do that also. I've even done it with peaches. If you get a tree-ripened peach, you can do it. I've done that with tomatoes. People never think to juice their tomatoes with that little hand. And it's cheap. You know, you can get one for like $30. And it's a workhorse. I have one that I'm still using from 20 years ago. And I juice every day. I've got 3 cases of citrus that was just picked this morning, and I'm going to be juicing it after the program today to give off to the staff. And because I like to juice everything, give it to the animals also. I make bottles up and give it to the animals. So juice, juice, juice. Do it right and get the maximum benefit, which means that the most expensive, high-end, very fast, in a second, those are not the ones I advocate. Also, one more of thousands of studies on green tea polyphenols, this is from Saitanam University in Japan, is that the stiffening of cancer cell membranes is the key biophysical mechanism of cancer prevention by green tea polyphenols. So take your green tea, and you're going to get the EGCG, that's the polyphenols, the EPA, gallocatechins, and those catechins, the gallate, that's what protects you from cancer. It's one of the best cancer protections or cancer therapies you can possibly use. And finally, from the Military Institute of Medicine in Poland, if you have low vitamin D as a child, you're far more subject to allergic reactions. All right, and take a nap every day. From the general psychiatry, it says that the naps are good because it staves off cognitive decline and dementia. That's good. And it makes you more alert. That's good. And it can rebalance your blood sugar. That's terrific. All right? And you could nap anywhere from 5 minutes to 20 minutes. Generally no more than a half hour. All right? So get your naps. And take some extra melatonin that protects your lungs against infection of novel coronavirus. Who says? University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. The hormone acts as a barrier against SARS-CoV-2, blocking the expression of genes that encode proteins in cells serving as viral entry points. That's according to the latest research. So that's what we want, and we want to protect ourselves. And this was published in the journal Pineal Research. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to go directly to the Senate hearing where 2 separate medical doctors are giving you their input. And by the way, this is months ago, on why hydroxychloroquine would be a good preventative for people just getting symptoms at low doses, that's the key, because the danger and some of the original studies that show don't use it were from high doses. I'm talking about collectively and cumulatively up to 10,000 milligrams in the body. When you don't want that, it's toxic above 5,000 milligrams, so you want 200 to 400 milligrams. And we have a lot of testimonials of physicians, but these are also medical doctors and scientists who are giving you this information, including professors, of one professor of medicine. Then I'm going to read you an article that attacks them. From all these people are professors at Yale University, then Richard Gale is coming on and show you why they're biased or they're ignorant of the research, because we have found, and Anthony Fauci, who is cited, is wrong. So you're going to come back and hear the people testifying under oath before Congress. Then you're going to hear the person who is testifying, who's being attacked, one of the world's most respected scientists who's now on the ropes. I mean, they're destroying his career. He's being attacked on CNN. Well, that should surprise no one. But then in that interview, the guy makes some statements that are flat out wrong, the journalist or alleged journalist, and I'm going to challenge him. I'm going to tell him he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's wrong. And Anthony Fauci is dead wrong. The last person in the world you should believe is the most powerful person in science, Anthony Fauci, because he's been wrong all along with deadly consequences. That is what we're going to take on. Then you'll have a chance to call in and share your points of view. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
We all understand the endemic disease that we are facing and that we have to face head on and not hide from it, hoping that it will go away. And so I'm going to give you my perspective on this. In May of this year, I observed that results of studies of a drug suggested to treat COVID, hydroxychloroquine, were being misrepresented, but what I thought at the time was sloppy reporting. We've heard from Dr. McCullough how COVID disease progresses in phases, from viral replication to florid pneumonia to multi-organ attack. Viral replication is an outpatient condition, but the pneumonia that fills the lungs with immune system debris and is life-threatening is hospitalizable. We've also heard how each phase, each pathologic aspect of the disease has to have its own specific treatment, how those treatments are derived from the biologic mechanisms of the disease. Thus, I was frankly astounded that the studies of hospital treatments were being represented as applying to outpatients in violation of what I had learned and how to treat patients in medical school. We're now finally coming to address why over the last 6 months, our government research institutions have invested billions of dollars in expensive patent medications and vaccine development, but almost nothing in outpatient, early outpatient treatments, the first line of response to this pandemic. And it's not that we've lacked candidate medications to study. We've had a number of promising agents. But I think that the early on conflation of hospital with outpatient disease served to imply that treatments of outpatient disease had been studied and found ineffective. This illogical premise motivated me to look at what actually the evidence for outpatient disease and its treatment were. So I want to reiterate that we are considering the evidence for early treatment of high-risk outpatients to prevent hospitalization and mortality. And that's it. I'm not talking about inpatient disease. That's a totally different consideration. I'm talking only about outpatient disease. So this is treatment starting in the first 5 days or so after the onset of symptoms. Treatment of older patients or patients with chronic conditions like diabetes or obesity, heart diseases, lung diseases, kidney diseases, immune system diseases, survivors from cancer, and so on. These are the people who are most likely to die from COVID, and they are the people most in need of prevention, protection. So in doing my research, I sought to obtain reports of every study of every medication pertaining to early treatment of high-risk outpatients. I monitor the literature daily, which is a task. And what I have found is actually remarkable. What I've observed is that while there have been positive reports of a number of drugs, every study of the outpatient use of one particular drug, hydroxychloroquine, with or without accompanying agents, has shown substantial benefit in reducing risks of hospitalization and mortality. Now, these studies break down into two major types. The first is the double-blinded, randomized controlled trials that various government and scientific personalities say provide the strongest, supposedly the only trustworthy form of evidence. The second is non-randomized but still controlled trials. There's some truth in that assertion about the nature of the quality of the evidence, but there's also much falsehood. We know, for example, that the great majority of drugs used to treat heart diseases were established before randomized controlled trials, with non-randomized trials. Cholesterol-lowering drugs were in widespread use before randomized trials were ever done. Azithromycin, which is the most common antibiotic used in children, was not established by randomized controlled trials. The great majority of drugs that are in use today were not established when they went into widespread use with randomized trials. Many of them had randomized trials later, but the establishment and use of drugs is not always done on the basis of randomized trials, but on the study with other kinds of studies. And thus, the idea that only randomized trials provide trustworthy evidence is a simplistic notion that sounds good in theory, and perhaps Dr. Zhao later may tell you that it's what many doctors believe, but this idea does not stand up to the body of medical studies and data that addresses it. And in fact, we have large amounts of empirical data looking at the difference between non-randomized and randomized trials. Dr. Tom Frieden, who was previously the director of the Centers for Disease Control, in 2017 wrote an extensive essay in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that non-randomized trials and randomized trials provide equivalent compelling evidence, equivalent evidence for the efficacy of treatments. So could you please enter the Frieden article into the record? Underlying this was a gigantic meta-analysis of meta-analyses, what I call a mega-analysis, done by the Cochrane Library Consortium, which is a British organization formed to organize evidence-based medical research. The Cochrane investigators examined what involved tens of thousands of study comparisons. This is a gigantic amount of data between randomized trials and their corresponding non-randomized counterparts. And when they compared these two kinds of studies, they found that they arrived at virtually identical conclusions. And please enter the Engelmeyer study also into the record. This evidence is why well-performed non-randomized trials are every bit as much of a gold standard today as the randomized trials you've heard of. This is empirical data, not opinions. This is empirical data. So what did I find when I investigated hydroxychloroquine in early use among outpatients? Right. The first thing is that this drug is extremely safe, exceedingly safe. We know this from common sense. This is a medication that's been used for 65 years by hundreds of millions of people in tens of billions of doses worldwide, prescribed without routine electrocardiogram screening. It's given to adults, to children, pregnant women, nursing mothers. Such a drug must be safe, and it must be safe when used in the initial.
Okay, you've heard what he had to say. He was saying that under oath, he had provided the panel with all the scientific evidence of it. He was immediately attacked. Here's what's interesting. Once you're attacked by Anthony Fauci's group and the people from the pharmaceutical industry and all their bots and sock puppets, etc., they go after your job, your career. He had a completely distinguished career. No controversies, no problems. And now it seems like many of the medical faculty at Yale are attacking him. This is just one example of a very biased and highly aggressive interview he did on CNN. We'll play a few minutes of it. Then we'll go to the attempt they made to totally destroy him.
Controversial op-ed in support of hydroxychloroquine. Dr. Risch, thanks so much for being with us this morning. I do appreciate your time. Why is it that you think Admiral Giroir, who you just heard right there, not to mention Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx, are wrong about what they're saying on hydroxychloroquine?
It's nice to be with you, John. So as of now, there are 12 studies that show that hydroxychloroquine plus zinc and other companion medications
when used early in high-risk outpatients, convey significant and a substantial benefit in reducing the risk of hospitalization and mortality. That's a very precise statement, which has very precise conditions for who are the people that need to be treated and how.
Let me just jump in here so people know what you're talking about, because when you wrote in the Newsweek op-ed, it was 7, now it's 12. None of those studies that you just cited are random placebo-controlled trials, what Dr. Anthony Fauci refers to as the gold standard. Listen to Dr. Fauci.
Any and all of the randomized placebo-controlled trials, which is the gold standard of determining if something is effective, none of them had shown any efficacy for hydroxychloroquine.
The random placebo-controlled trials, none of them have shown efficacy, correct?
That's not actually correct. The problem with those randomized controlled trials is they were trials done on the wrong people. They were trials done on low-risk people who have very, very low risks of hospitalization and mortality. So you don't do a study of prostate cancer in women to prevent prostate cancer in women, because nobody's going to get the outcome. And that's what those studies did. The Boulware studies and the Mijas studies in Catalonia, they were all on very low-risk people who are not going to get it and hospitalized, you know, or die, by and large, and we don't treat those people. We treat high-risk people.
Well, look, okay, to that argument, again, your paper in Newsweek goes on to suggest the problem is they're not being tested, hydroxy's not being tested on outpatient people, not hospitalized people. So a little shift in your argument there from what you wrote in Newsweek already. The fact of the matter is...
No, I'm sorry, I think that's a mistake.
The fact of the matter is there are studies out, these random placebo-controlled trials, including the one just published in JAMA, the one that was published in JAMA before from University of Albany, and there was one published just a few days ago that comes out of the University of Minnesota. It's tested on people early on in the process, correct? Which is the same type of trial that you were citing as proving benefits. Again, there are no random placebo-controlled trials that show a benefit, correct?
No, you're misstating what I said. I said it had to be in high-risk people. In fact, in my Newsweek paper, as well as my American Journal of Epidemiology papers, I said outpatients, high-risk. People over 60 with obesity or diabetes or cardiovascular diseases, those are the people who get treated. Young people with no conditions don't need to be treated by and large, unless in rare cases they present with shortness of breath. They don't need to be treated. But those were the people who were studied in the Boulware, Minnesota trials and in the Spain trials and so on. So as I've said, you have to treat the right people and you have to study the right people. Those studies did not study the right people, period. That's the bottom line.
The study published in JAMA published a wide range of ages and people in different situations, and they were given the drug over different times. Again, the question is, why haven't any random placebo-controlled trials showed benefit? And isn't that a problem for an epidemiologist?
No. In fact, the FDA has a huge history of drugs going into widespread use in the medical community for decades that have not been established on the basis of randomized controlled trials. Half of the chemotherapy drugs used in cancer were used without randomized controlled trials. The antibiotics, amoxicillin, for example, that parents use with their children all the time, day in, day out, was never established with a randomized controlled trial before it was used. We have a whole vast medical literature that was not the standard. So why is it suddenly the standard now when there's other reasons?
I don't think it is suddenly the standard. That is the way the FDA operates. It's the way that Dr. Fauci operates. And I've been speaking to a number of epidemiologists over the last few days who also are frankly shocked that you've moved the bar so much on these randomized placebo-controlled trials. Let me just read something, what someone...
Okay. As you can see, the interviewer was on the attack, and he was not looking at the literature. We've looked at the literature. Here are some of the statements subsequent to that where they've gone after him. This is, quote, a statement from Yale faculty on hydroxychloroquine and its use in COVID-19. Quote, we write with grave concern that too many are being distracted by the ardent advocacy of our Yale colleague, Dr. Harvey Riesch, to promote the assertion that hydroxychloroquine, when given with antibiotics, is effective in treating COVID-19, in particular as an early therapeutic intervention for the disease. As his colleagues, we defend the right of Dr. Risch, a respected cancer epidemiologist, to voice his opinions, but he is not an expert in infectious disease epidemiology. He has not been swayed by the body of scientific evidence from rigorous conducted clinical trials, which refute the plausibility of his belief and arguments. Over the last few weeks, all of us have spent considerable time explaining the evidence behind hydroxychloroquine research as it applies to early and late-stage COVID-19 patients in the scientific community and general public, and now are compelled to detail the evidence in this open letter. We are seriously alarmed for the safety of patients and coherence and effectiveness of our national COVID-19 emergency response when misinformation about hydroxychloroquine is spread and when rigorous scientific evidence and consensus produced by the community of expert researchers in infectious disease and federal agencies, national and global health organizations are not heeded. Let us be clear, we are unanimous in our desire to see the development of therapies to treat COVID-19 and prevent the transmission or of the acquisition of SARS-CoV. If hydroxychloroquine was shown to be effective, even among subgroups of patients with COVID-19 and ongoing high-quality risk, we would join our colleagues in promoting access to for all of it. However, the evidence thus far has been unambiguous in refuting the premise that hydroxychloroquine is a potentially effective early therapy for COVID-19. That's part of what they had to say. So they're denouncing any benefit whatsoever and even saying that, you know, it's dangerous. Richard Gale, respond to all of these nearly 20 medical doctors and PhDs from Yale and what we found that they don't seem to have known existed.
Gary, it was kind of amusing to just listening to just not the doctors from Yale, which isn't surprising. Yale Medical School is extremely conservative. And also, by the way, Yale University is one of the number one recruiting grounds, you know, for our intelligence agency as well. Anyway, but listening to that, I was kind of taken by the Anglo-American centrism, as if doctor, unless you have your medical degree from U.S. and you're practicing in the U.S., then that we should only be listening to those doctors, and any doctors in other nations are just to be ignored, that they don't have that. So if we really look at the death rates in countries that have relied upon hydroxychloroquine for the treatment of COVID-19, there is a dramatic lower death rate across the board in those countries that use the drug compared to those that discourage its use. And there was a study. Now, this is not a complete, this is an ongoing study that I just came across, but looking at all the different countries in the world. And it actually, what it's doing, it's inherently a country randomized control trial. It's not a placebo. So that CNN announcer was talking about placebo. But you don't, when you're in the midst of a health crisis and people's lives are at stake, you don't control placebo studies. It would be unethical. And that's pretty much that's quite standard, around the world. You can do kind of a randomized control, but you're not going to use a placebo per se, because you're jeopardizing a person's health by doing a placebo, just an inert substance if they're ill or sick. So those aren't done. That is a real red herring argument that he was saying. But there was this kind of a country randomized control trial that was done looking at across the world. It included this trial 1.8 billion people, and breaking up in the treatment groups with using the hydroxychloroquine, and others were in the nations that were not using it. And there, at first, when this study's ongoing, they're constantly adding data and updating it as the months go by. So at first, it was 69.9% lower death rate for those countries that are using the hydroxychloroquine. That number's now up to 79% compared to the countries that aren't. And when you look at some of these countries, you know, Russia, It only has a death rate of 484 per million compared to the U.S. I mean, the U.S. right now, we're at 1,300 deaths per million. India, which has a huge population with 10,000.7 million cases, but HCQ is prescribed throughout. They only have a death rate of 112 per million. And you can go through all these different countries and you get similar to Turkey, and there's many countries, Israel, Wuhan and China, where HCQ is encouraged, South Korea, Brazil. These countries have refused to stop prescribing HCQ. A very interesting example was Switzerland, because Switzerland at first started with the HCQ right away, but then through all the pressure from the European Union, World Health Organization, they discontinued it for a little while, and their death rates just shot up. So they've been secretly allowing doctors to just prescribe it, and the death rates have declined dramatically. And so what I'm finding that there's these kind of these similar statistics when we look at other countries. Now, of course, the big argument that Fauci and the FDA and World Health Organization were giving was that the drug has adverse effects. But this is a drug that's been used for 65 years, and nobody ever questioned it before, up until just less than a year ago, we're questioning its safety profile. And so all of a sudden we're concerned now, 65 years later, about its safety profile. And just as another thing, there's another drug. We've spoken about remdesivir at times, but there's another drug also that's being touted by the U.S. federal agencies, and that's dexamethasone. It's another experimental drug. But when I look at that, there is no rigorous peer-reviewed testing has been done on this. And this is an experimental drug, just as remdesivir. Experimental drugs should require rigorous peer review testing for efficacy and safety. They are experimental. It's very different than something like ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine that have been in use for quite a few decades. So I could say a lot more. We should remember that there's
two quick. I have just a couple questions to finish this segment. I need short answers. When he appeared on that CNN report, and when he appeared before Congress, he had between at the beginning 7 studies, and then it went up to 14 studies. How many studies are now in the peer-reviewed literature on hydroxychloroquine?
There's 171 peer-reviewed, all total are 237 studies. So
237.
So we're looking at like 60 additional ones, and 195 of those are comparing hydroxychloroquine with a control group.
Okay. So the bottom line is these scientists are wrong. The interviewer on CNN was inaccurate. For example, why didn't the doctor say, show me the peer-reviewed double-blind placebo-controlled studies on open-heart surgery, on balloon angioplasty, on coronary bypass? You can't. They don't exist. Show me the ones on the removal of glioblastomas and astrocytomas from the brain. You can't. They don't exist. And you start going down all the different medical procedures that are accepted that have had no placebo-controlled because of ethical reasons. So you see, that's a red herring that he was using. And anyone with a science background, any beginning scientist would know that. So again, Anthony Fauci has been wrong so many times. Why don't any of these journalists ask Anthony Fauci, didn't you promote the use of AZT? Wasn't that shown to be a fraudulent double-blind placebo-controlled study? I interviewed the person who did the research and brought in files to me, a foot thick, of how the study was unblinded. People were using AZT and not the placebo because they wanted the AZT, and people were dying and they were not being counted in the deaths. So this is what we're dealing with today. This is how bad science is. It's whatever Anthony Fauci says, Anthony Fauci gets. And he's not criticized or questioned, and he should be, because some people believe that he is responsible for up to 75,000 deaths in HIV positive but otherwise asymptomatic people who were encouraged to take AZT and they died, and you could not distinguish the difference in AZT deaths from HIV deaths. No arguments there, though, not in the media, not in the scientific community. Thank you very much, Richard. And okay, by the way, ivermectin is even better. He even has a higher percentage. Now, mind you, this is at a time when there's no other medicine being given, no other treatments that are offered, hoping a person just doesn't get too sick and ends up in a hospital. Then they have to go to emergency procedures, which are less radical than what they were. Hence, people have a better chance. But we already heard how many people are surviving using hydroxychloroquine, 68 to 79%, and ivermectin, 90%. Well, then multiply that from the beginning, because both have been around this time. And how many Americans, how many people worldwide would have saved? Between 70 and 90% of people would not have died or had a longer life. And both of those were rejected by the Fauci group. So that tells you about where their interests are. Richard Gale, thanks for coming on and sharing that. We will defend the merits of good science, especially at a time when many of these people are just being destroyed. Their reputation's destroyed. And we're also not focusing upon all of the people who are dying using the vaccines, as if somehow for the greater good. You mean the greater good of the pharmaceutical companies? Huh? What are we talking about here? There's just so much politicalization of this. Your thoughts. I'm going to set some time aside for you to call in and share your points of view. Call us at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And while you're thinking about what you'd like to talk about, just a few things that I want to share with you. One is that a week from Sunday, that's the first Sunday coming up in February, at noon, I'm going to be doing a webinar, and the webinar is going to be about where do we go from here? All the questions you have now because of coronavirus impacting you, especially people who thought that they could withstand, you know, a short-term closing of a business or, you know, staying home for 2 weeks. Now it's 9 months, 10 months, and all the things that happen when you're being told your kid must be vaccinated, you must be vaccinated in some states, or you could lose your job, or your employers are now in New York State allowed to force you to be vaccinated, come back to work, and you don't want, for whatever reasons, you don't want that sovereignty of your own physical body choice taken away from you. The other reasons, people are just no longer happy with the quality of life in the environment where they're living. It's changed and it's not coming back. Everything comes back in time, but it doesn't come back the way it was. And for lots of people, quality of life matters. What do we do? Where do we go? Where are there safe places? Where are there places where the government isn't constantly trying to dominate every choice in our lives? How can we get off their grid? How can we stop being surveyed? Which platforms can we go to and still download information from quality authors and watch podcasts that inform and inspire us instead of everything that is counter to the official narrative being deplatformed? That's what's important. And to do that, then I put together the program I'm going to be sharing. Lots of brand new information. I've been looking all over the world, the best places throughout the world to live that are sustainable and wonderful and quality of life in the United States, how to get there. What are the places I would not suggest to go to? Now, historically, I've done programs on where you couldn't live in the future because it's not going to be sustainable. This is about different issues. If you have a business, what do you do if that business cannot be finished? What if you have a mortgage? Do you keep paying a mortgage on a property where there's no quality of life? What's the point of that? People are just confused about what to do. Where's the healthiest places to live? Where's the happiest places to live? How do you get there? What if you're single? What if you're old? What if you have no money? So all these are the issues I'm going to take on. to help you go from where you're at to the next step in your life. And that's what we want to do. Go from where we're at to the next step. So if you'd like to join me in this webinar, and please keep in mind, every webinar I've ever done has been sold out. So you'll go to prn.fm, get the information, and sign up. Or you can call our reception desk at 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. You'll speak with Jessica, and she can give you the information also. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.